Welcome to the Pin Down, your Detroit Pistons podcast. I'm your host, Wes Davenport from Motor City Hoop and Detroit Bad Boys.
And I'm Blake Silverman, writer for Detroit Bad Boys, covering everything from the Pistons to the NBA draft and the Motor City Cruise.
Blake, I thought like when we got in with the stream here that you got a haircut or something. I mean, you're looking sharp. What's in the hair right now? What's the style? What are you doing with it? Because it's looking good.
Oh, man. Just long work day. Had to get myself together a little bit before we hopped on the stream. And you know, it's the weather's getting warm out. I try to keep it a little shorter just so it's more manageable. But no haircut since the last time I saw you. But yeah, maybe I'm doing something a little different today. I don't know.
I mean, for the listeners at home, like you guys, you're not watching, you can't see, but Blake, he's got some mousse in there or something. Like it's looking sharp. I'm over here in a collared shirt because I didn't get to change after work. Like this is probably the most dapper we've been on a recording of the podcast. And I just think that deserves a shout out.
Hey, definitely. The season's officially over and the hot topic now is front office league executives. So I guess got to do the part as well. And also dressing up just to, you know, celebrate the end of a horrible, horrible season.
Yeah, I know we got one comment asking what we did to celebrate the end of the bad year. This is it. We got on a podcast and got all, you know, dressed up to look good for, you know, half of the listeners that show up at the stream. I had one other thing I wanted to ask you before we got started talking about the president of basketball operations search, the end of the season, off season, all that stuff. I want to vent for a second because I this morning I went outside and I went and I looked at the side of my house and the gutter, the downspout from the gutter, like ripped off from the side of the house, pulled some vinyl siding along with it. I have no idea how this happened. And it feels like this kind of stuff just happens all the time. I know you own a home. What's the most recent, like just random out of the blue, oh gosh, I have to fix that now thing that has happened to you? That's what I'm thinking about.
Oh my gosh. The gutter thing actually happened to me at my old house and it was like wood siding. So luckily all I had to do was figure out how to screw it back together. But oh man, what is the most recent thing? You know, the big project, and it's not even really a project that we're undergoing right now, is our deck is just in rough shape. We wanted to stain it last year, never got around to it. We did replace a few boards, but you know, got a wood deck, wood rots with all the weather and everything. So that's the big project of the summer. Nothing has necessarily went wrong, but it's just one of those things. Every time I look at it, it's just a headache. And in the back of my head, I'm like, I have to do something about this.
You're going to get a kick out of this thing. Because one of the first like projects that I did after we bought the house that we're in was to restain the deck. We've just kind of got like a back patio. It's just flat wood deck. There's no railings, no nothing on it. It's just a pad, basically. And I did the rookie homeowner mistake. I just got down and I stained it. Well, I didn't strip it. I didn't sand it. I didn't prep it, nothing. So it looked good for about a week. And we've got dogs. So you know, yeah. Those claws just went and ripped it up. It's in rough shape again. And I'm just staring at it like,
yeah,
I probably won't get to it this summer, but that's on the list. So I feel you.
Decks are work, man. We want to do one of those like, I don't even know what the material is, but the longer lasting ones, so you don't really have to deal with it, but that costs money. So if you're thinking about building a deck, maybe just think about something else. They're a lot.
There you go. That's the homeowner advice segment of the Pin Down. We've got a ton of questions, though, so we're just going to get right into that, guys. The first one, I mean, it's top of mind for everybody. It's just kind of general thoughts here. This is from a fellow in the DBB comments, but just kind of general thoughts about the hiring of a new president of basketball operations. So we found out last week that Tom Gores is going to hire somebody above everybody else in the front office, is at least how it's being presented right now. So that means above Troy Weaver, that means above guys like Ed Stefanski, anyone else who had a prominent voice outside of probably Arntone, because I know that he has some level of ownership stake at this point. So he'll probably be involved in that hiring process, at least to some degree. I would assume. I'm not reporting that. I would just assume, since he has some level of ownership stake. Regardless, this is going to be an individual that comes in and resets the vision of Detroit basketball. He will then immediately have a decision to make on Monty Williams, on Troy Weaver, on the rest of the staff. That includes scouting, assistant GMs, the whole nine. Tom Gores has basically said, I'm not making the decision. I'm going to hire someone who knows better than I do to go and make that decision for me. So what a fellow is asking here is, what are your thoughts on hiring a new president of basketball operations? And will more cooks in the kitchen really help? So, Blake, you know, I'm curious what just your thoughts were when you saw that announcement. And to a fellow's question, you know, do you think there are going to be a lot of cooks in the kitchen, or do you expect the new person to kind of whittle things down? What are your expectations at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I like the announcement. I feel like it's an announcement that things are going to happen. Like, we knew change was coming. We didn't really know what it was. Now we know for sure there is going to be a lead basketball executive coming in. I mean, we knew things were heading that way from the reporting from James Edwards and Omari. So my thing with, like, it makes sense. We all knew it was coming for a bit. My thing with it is I feel like it kind of has to happen quickly, because how it's being framed and the way things are being put across is this new hire is going to have a say on whether Troy Weaver stays around, whether Monty Williams stays around, and be really like the final decision maker in that process. So say there are moves there, like Troy Weaver, if this new president of basketball operations, if they part with Troy Weaver, I feel like that's less of a concern, because this president of basketball ops can make those decisions in terms of the draft and then the trade. I don't really know how many teams that do have someone in this position, like when they have a general manager, how big that say is. But if you're going to be hiring a new head coach, you got to start that pretty quickly, like almost ASAP. So we have this search underway right now, and depending on what that person does coming in, there may be more searches down the road. Maybe there are people in waiting, something behind the scenes that we don't know. But I'm just like, you just got off of a historically bad season. And yes, changes are happening, but we almost just need to light a fire under ourselves to make these changes happen, because you have a draft coming up. You have an offseason that is critical coming up. So I'm just worried about the whole time aspect of it, but I am a fan of it in the long run, because something needed to happen when you win 14 games.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in terms of how the process is working here, with the GM, with Troy Weaver specifically, right? So I think it makes a lot of sense. I'll just put it that way, because you're going to bring someone in who is the new decision maker on all things basketball. They've got people that handle all the business side of the organization. By all accounts, the business side of the organization is doing just fine. Valuation on the team is good. No issues over there. So this person is going to come in and handle literally everything basketball related. Now, if you get that position, even if you were going to immediately fire Troy Weaver, you knew that when you were hired, you were going to fire the previous GM, you still get a chance now to do an exit interview, or at least do an interview, maybe not acting, but exploring the possibility of this person staying around. And in that kind of interview, you're going to get access to scouting information, just free agency stuff, internal information that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. It kind of lets this individual, whoever they hire, kind of go through interviews up and down the organization, get a feel for where things are at from people that are already in it right now. Now, obviously, we as fans, we really do not want whatever has been going on to continue in terms of the way this roster is being built out. So I'm not saying that this person, the new person, is going to be able to get in and get all this really valuable insider info and just continue the process. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the person's going to get in, get all that insider information, and now be fresh eyes and can do whatever they want with it. But they're not going to be behind anymore. Like, you look at when Troy Weaver was hired, he was hired pretty close to that draft. That's the draft we end up with Killian Hayes, Saban Lee, Sadiq Bey, and Isaiah Stewart, 1-for-4, right? You can't excuse going 1-for-4, but the fact that he was hired so quickly or so close to the draft maybe explains it a little bit. You know, do you know what I'm saying there? So I don't think there's going to be that negative side of it in terms of the timeline that way with draft, free agency, and trades. I'm right there with you with the coach. If they end up moving on from the coach, it's a little bit more concerning just in terms of throwing all of these young guys into limbo again. But you do have a lot more time for that decision. I mean, we saw how long it took them to hire Monty Williams, and you know, truthfully, there really wasn't any system issue going into the season. By the time they got started, it was other issues that brought the ship down. I want to bring up this comment here from Coffee. He says that bringing in the new person, it's not going to solve the problem because the problem is Tom Gores. And one, I just kind of wanted your take on it. And then I was hoping to respond to it as well, because I've got a thought. But I was curious to see what you would think here.
Yeah, I mean, where I think the biggest problem lies right now is in the front office, just because that's how the roster was constructed. I mean, again, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, what strings are being pulled, what say that Gores has in terms of like roster decisions. I know when he spoke with the beat writers when the losing streak was going on, he said it's like gotten to the point where he's talking rotations with Monty Williams. Like, I doubt he's always that involved or really much involved. I don't know. Like, I think I said this a couple weeks ago. I don't necessarily think Gores is the problem. I get the team hasn't been good since he purchased them. But I think that lies more in the front office, not even specifically Troy Weaver, the front offices that were in place before him. So I don't think like owners really just sell teams because they do bad. Like, there are plenty of other issues why owners sell teams, whether it's because it's a business decision for them or like issues that like we saw in Phoenix last year. That's not really there with Gores for me. So I think you make these front office changes. Maybe that comes along with some changes to your coaching staff, and it definitely comes along with changes to your roster and start there. But like, I don't think that like ownership is a real issue. And I think there's not, like, I don't think we're going to wake up magically one day and Tom Gores is going to be like, all right, I'm selling the team.
So I bring this up. I brought this one up from Coffee because I'm very sympathetic to the point of view that all of this kind of comes back to Gores. Like, I get it. And I think it's a little complicated because if you zoom back out and you just look at what Tom Gores has done as an owner of the Pistons, you really can't ask for all that much more, right? He's not involved on personnel decisions. The only trade or movement that we know of for sure that he nixed was a trade of Andre Drummond to the Sacramento Kings on draft night way back when with Stan Van Gundy. That is to date the only thing that we know he had direct influence in, you know, rejecting it and not allowing that to happen. So he doesn't really meddle in personnel decisions. He lets the people that he hire go do what he hired them to do. That's good. You don't want a meddling GM. He's very hands-off. I mean, people point out as a negative thing that he's not courtside at all the games. And okay, sure, maybe he'd feel more like a fan if he was courtside at all the games. But again, if we're going to have one or the other, it's almost better to just have the non-interested owner, the owner that just is going to hire someone and let them do their job up and down the organization, because owners aren't basketball geniuses. They bought the team because they want to make money and they like the NBA. And that's about the extent of it. Okay. The problem here, and what kind of makes this complex, is even given all of that, Tom Corris has hired all of the decision makers in the past. So the challenging part is that, has his actions as a owner been generally good and acceptable in terms of the things you definitely don't want to see an owner doing? Yes, absolutely. But he also really hasn't hired historically great people to do the jobs, at least in hindsight. In the moment, many of them made a lot of sense. Like, I don't want to disparage Troy Weaver directly or Stan Van Gundy or even Monty Williams or Dwayne Casey, any of these guys. These are all better basketball minds than me, okay? But in hindsight, they were probably the wrong fit at the wrong time. So now we as fans, we're left to sit here and go, well, he doesn't do the things that bad owners do, but he also hasn't hired amazing people for these jobs, and we have to trust him to hire him another one, and this one's going to be better. So, like, I get it. I'm really sympathetic to what Coffey's saying. At the end of the day, though, I think you're right. It comes down to the roster decisions that have been made. It comes down to, at least most recently, a disconnect in vision between the GM, the coach, and other voices within the organization. All of these things are much bigger issues than the ownership. And me, I would much rather have the owner that they do and let him continue to take stabs at hiring someone good than to risk moving on and getting someone much worse that's much more involved actively in these processes, because the downside of that is a lot. I mean, they just set a franchise record. So I can't say it's worse than what we've seen, but it's a little uglier. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I actually have a question on how you bring up, I guess, the hires that Gores has made. I feel like, I mean, I'm only going back maybe like 5, 6 years, like let's say since the Stan Van era, other than Troy Weaver, like, is it time that the organization, Gores, takes a shot on a candidate that isn't as proven, but is like that up and comer? Because, I mean, Stan Van, Casey, going to get Monty Williams. Troy Weaver wasn't necessarily proven, but he was a huge part of that Oklahoma City team. I think it's a little bit different of a debate whether you want that person leading your front office or as like giving them a shot at head coach. But I feel like that's maybe been the pattern. So I'm wondering if you think Gore should change his frame of thinking in terms of who he hires.
Well, I don't have an answer to that one. I think it's really interesting, right? Because you are absolutely spot on. You go back and you look at the hires. It's Stan Van Gundy. It's Ed Stefanski, who was a former GM. Arn Tellem, who was a very, very highly respected agent, ran a big agency in all of that. Arn Tellem is incredibly respected around the league. Monty Williams, Dwayne Casey. The only outlier is Troy Weaver, who was very unproven at the time. And if you look at what they did, I mean, it's at least reasonable to assume that while Weaver was the final decision maker, there sure were a lot of voices in the room, right? I think that's fair to say, and you can take from that whatever you want. So will they revert back to going for someone a little more proven? Will they dip back into the well and maybe adjust their strategy with it this time? I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to follow. And on that note, let's get to this question here from KCP for three, and it's through. It says, what are your thoughts on each of the rumored candidates for the president of basketball operations so far? And what we've got, this is from both James Edwards and Omari Sankofa at the Free Press. We had John Horst, who's currently Milwaukee's GM, John Hammond, who has some Pistons ties, Neil Oshley, who was the former Portland general manager, Bryson Graham, who's a little bit more in the Troy Weaver vein, like you had mentioned, current assistant GM at the Pelicans, and then Dwayne Casey, who we're all pretty familiar with at this point. So what's your thoughts on that early list? I do want to say I know that on the Pistons, Paul Somare mentioned that he got the sense the Pistons themselves were a little surprised by some of the names on this list, given that they hadn't really discussed to the agency they had tapped to search for these candidates yet. So, I mean, all these names, let's take them with a grain of salt, is all I'm saying. But what are your thoughts with all of these?
Yeah, when reading James Edwards' article, the one name, and I think it was the first name he listed that stuck out to me, was John Horst. James said to like keep an eye on what's going on in Milwaukee, but I just thought that name made sense. He used to work for the Pistons. He went to school at Rochester University, which, shameless plug, is right by where I live. So I feel like I personally was just like, oh, that would be super cool. And it makes sense. He's a Michigan guy, has had extreme success at this level, helped build a championship team. I know James also said the one candidate, John Hammond, was the one who drafted Giannis, traded for Chris Middleton, and then left. And then John Horst was the GM. So the John Horst name stuck out to me. Neil Shea, he was fired in Portland for like toxic workplace allegations. I think that would be a risky move just based on where the organization is. I feel like this needs to be a home run hire. And the most, I guess, not controversial, but up for discussion name to me was Dwayne Casey, because he's obviously the most familiar name, familiar face. We know he's been involved with scouting and what joined the front office after he stepped down as coach last year. So I think that's an interesting one. We know he hasn't always, like, he's been very involved in talent development no matter where he is. So it's an interesting one. I feel like that one would bring out the most discourse between the fan base. I think he could do a good job. It's just, I don't know. And also there's an element of it when talking about front office names. I think we talked about this maybe months ago. It's tough to determine who the right candidate for this is, because you've mentioned Omari and James Edwards have mentioned, like, the team is tapping in a search form to bring a candidate list and help with the search process. We're not involved with that. We don't have this information. And I'm certainly not tapped in with as many like front office names as I'd like to be.
A couple other ones that Omari mentioned, I think this was published today, it might have been yesterday, but he brings up Tayshaun Prince, who's currently with the Memphis Grizzlies front office, Shane Battier, who is not currently, in the NBA, but was an executive with the Miami Heat, and then as well, Mark Hughes, who is involved with the Clippers front office right now. I'm with you. I don't have any insight into any of these. I mean, especially looking at hindsight with the Troy Weaver hire, right? Like, when he was hired, there were only good things said about the guy and his ability to evaluate talent, all of this. And I mean, who could have predicted that this was how it was going to go? I'm not aware of anybody. If anyone's got the receipts, feel free to send that over. I didn't see it. At least I don't remember it. So yeah, I feel very similar to how I felt last year with the coaching search. There are so many people that have influence on all of these front office decisions, and it's so hard without knowing any of these people personally to make a judgment as a fan from the outside looking in on who would be good, who would be poor at it. Jonathan Schwartz brings up Grant Hill. He's with USA Basketball, obviously. I mean, that could make a lot of sense. That would at least be fun. Tayshaun Prince would be fun. I think Dwayne Casey is a fun name in terms of guys that you know for certain that the owner trusts. I mean, Dwayne Casey's got to be up there pretty highly at this point. He was a very highly respected coach. He's still involved with the front office. I mean, we know just public information, he's extraordinarily well respected throughout the league, both in front offices and with other coaches as well as players. You know, maybe that's something interesting. We saw Boston promote a coach into their front office, Brad Stevens, and that certainly worked out well for them, though they started from a much higher point than we're at now. Coffee brings up Bob Myers. I don't know. He's pretty complicit here with how the Warriors have crumbled as time has gone on. But he did put them together at the same time. So maybe. I mean, all these names, I think they're all interesting. And I can just try and pick who would be the most fun for me. But I don't really have much to go on at all in terms of who would be the best at the job.
Yeah, I will say the one name, and this is from when we had this discussion, like in the losing streak, where who are candidates for this? And I mean, neither of us really knew. I did some research, and one of the names that popped up as like high rising executives is Jeff Peterson, who was a right hand in Brooklyn, but he was hired in Charlotte, basically in the same position to lead their team. Woj had him on his podcast probably a month ago, which I gave it a listen to. And I mean, it, from what I read, it like carried over into listening to him talk and how he was talking about moving that organization forward. I think that one would have been cool, but now off the table. So what can you do? So yeah, there's only so much research, I guess, you can do. And when we don't even really know what's going on behind the scenes, what they're looking for and who it's ultimately going to be.
All right, before we move off the topic and get to a great question here from our guy Camille, I want to ask you this. Let's call our shot, both of us, but you go first, all right? Not say who's going to get hired, but after the person gets hired, who is then kept and who is fired? It could be both. It could be both in either category, however you want to split it up. But between Monty Williams and Troy Weaver, call your shot. Who's sticking around if either of them?
And this is honestly just a guess. I think Troy will not be around any longer. I just think it's difficult to, with the situation, I think it's difficult to stick around. I mean, maybe something is worked out where he's doing more of that like scouting or whatever it is. I just don't see it. Not, I think Monty stays. I could see a world where they're both gone, where they're both staying. But right now, what my gut is telling me is Troy is no longer here, but Monty is still the coach of the team next year. What do you think?
Well, I completely agree with you. So let me ask you this. Let's play in fantasy land. Like you are hired as the next president of basketball operations for the Detroit Pistons.
My gosh.
Would you be comfortable having the former GM who was making all the scouting and GM decisions around on your shoulder, whispering in your ear?
Probably not.
No, me either. Me either. That was the same thing that I would pose last offseason when some people were wondering if Dwayne Casey was really going to stick around maybe on the coaching staff or not. Like, if you were a new coach and you got hired, would you want the old guy still around on the bench? Like, oh, no way. I think it's the same thing here. So, yeah, I completely agree. When they hire someone else, I assume there'll be a couple interviews, and then that'll be it. Troy Weaver will move on, hopefully somewhere else, and hopefully he does land a job in a front office somewhere. I mean, by all accounts, he is a good scout. So hopefully he can fall back on that. And then I likely think that Monty Williams is sticking around. Derek Brown, man, we appreciate you. Thank you for that. He's looking forward to watching. So we appreciate that. Let's get to this question here from Camille. He says, be honest. In a scenario where everything goes well, what can this team do next season? So, like, if they have a perfect offseason, what do you think the ceiling is next season? And this is obviously early. I mean, we're recording on April 18th, so a lot can change. But what do you think?
Yeah, first, shout out to you, Camila. Thanks for the question. I think I mean, I feel like realistically, if you're being a realist, you can't expect this team to win anything more than 30 games next season. So if everything goes perfectly, maybe it's somewhere in that 31 to 35 range. But yeah, the tough part about where the team is at now is there hasn't been, I mean, they haven't been good for a very long time. There hasn't been much, if any, there's been progress because you have Cade Cunningham and some interesting young pieces, but the team hasn't made jumps. So I don't know. I just don't think you can expect them to magically turn things around. Like, this thing is going to take time, especially when you're bringing in a new leader of your front office, a new head coach, potentially a new GM, potentially. Like, they're not starting from scratch, but they're also not in a scenario where they just are like one piece away from being a playoff team.
My heart really wants to even go higher than what you said. But I'm gonna cite a piece that friend of the show Jack Kelly published on Detroit Bad Boys last offseason, near the end. He went back and he was looking at former teams that had the worst record in the NBA and then the improvement that they all made year to year. Because at the time, we were all fans. We were trying to figure out what's a reasonable guess to the amount of wins that the Pistons could win this season. Obviously, all of us guessed way too high. But the trick was that looking through all of those teams, the only team that made a really significant jump, and by significant, I mean more than about 10 to 12 wins, was that San Antonio Spurs team that drafted Tim Duncan. And mind you, they drafted Tim Duncan because David Robinson, I believe, was just out the entire season previously. So they kind of already had a ready-made roster to compete, and then they added a generational prospect to it. That being said, maybe if all the right decisions are made, this Pistons team does get into the 28 wins, 30 win range. I mean, at that's getting close to a 15 win improvement at that point. And while I will be the first to tell you that history is not an incredible predictor of the future, and that you as an individual are not representative of the average, I absolutely agree with all of those things. But it would be historically rare for the Pistons to win 10 more games next season than they did this year. And for all the excuses that were there last year, a lot of them are gone now. Last year Cade was out. They dealt with a ton of injuries to, key guys. This year, the injuries weren't nearly as impactful, and Cade Cunningham played the whole season. So I guess that's my Debbie Downer answer. Maybe like an 8-win improvement is more in the lines of reasonable and would be less precedent setting historically.
How many, like, I'm thinking of Houston right now, and while Houston wasn't the best team or the worst team in the league last year, I feel like they did a pretty considerable 1 year leap. Like, they won 41 games this year, and I want to say they were,
They
I'm trying
weren't the
to,
worst team in the league.
yeah, exactly. So they won 22 games the year before, so that's almost like a 20
Yeah.
game improvement. We all know how they use their cap space. I mean, they
Right.
hired a new coach that is obviously doing a good job. So, yeah, I don't know if like an outcome like that is really on the table for the Pistons, but that's the one example that I can think of that is current.
All right, let's get to this one here. This is from Derek Brown, and we also got the question from Gregory 1988 in the DBB comments. So Derek Brown's asking about Patrick Williams And Gregory wants us to do the math here on what they would have to offer to pry away Patrick Williams from the Chicago Bulls if we assume they want to re-sign DeMar DeRozan. So let me ask you both of those. Do you have interest in Patrick Williams, adding him to this roster? And if so, what do you think the contract would be for them to kind of swipe him away out from under the Chicago Bulls' nose?
Yeah, I guess this is like an interesting one because I don't think second round picks is going to do it. I feel like you have to give up one of the young pieces and then maybe draft capital. Like, I don't think Sasser would do it. Like, I feel like it's almost,
he is a free agent.
Patrick Williams is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So he's restricted, not restricted free agent. Yeah. This year. Yeah. So we have to throw an offer sheet at him.
Right.
Got it. Yeah, I think it was Zach Lowe last year talking about how the extension that Patrick Williams wanted, he heard, was very high, like probably something that he would never get. But I don't know. Do you think like something in the like 25 a year range, like, is that right? Or am I just spitballing there?
So looking on Spotrac, the Bulls are not in a great spot cap-wise. I think with all of the cap holds, if I'm reading this right, they're already into the luxury tax, but they're well below the second apron. And they do hold bird rights for DeMar DeRozan. That's not going to prevent them from re-signing him. But you got to assume he's going to make quite a bit of money. DeRozan's cap hold right now in this offseason is about 43, and it looks like they are about 57 or so under the second apron, where that tax bill goes up even higher. So all that's to say, I would bet it's somewhere above 25, maybe close to that 30 mark. I mean, Patrick Williams is not a guy that's produced at that level yet. This is absolutely a bet on the future. This might be a situation where you're able to get a declining deal, maybe for 3 years with a player option at the end of that. We're kind of in the Lauri Markkanen structure, where it starts off fairly high, precipitates later on. It's kind of a tough spot. I mean, they could definitely force the Bulls' hand here and offer him enough money to just take him away outright. The question is Patrick Williams a guy that you think would validate that kind of contract, Blake?
Right. It, like you said, and I mean, like YouTube user brings up here, it's definitely a risk for a guy who has had injury issues, for a guy who has had production issues as well. I'm with you that it's definitely, I mean, to be honest, even like giving Cade Cunningham a max deal is a bet for the future. Like, we know what he is, but he hasn't, I guess, like really won at a certain level. Like, it's not, so all rookie maxes are like that. I guess, not saying that Patrick Williams would get anything close to a max. But yeah, if, like, you don't want to be in a situation where it's like 3 years from now and you're like, oh man, you're paying Patrick Williams $25 million a year and he's like that your seventh or eighth guy in the rotation, and you need to attach assets to offload that contract. The risk reward is very high on that one. I don't know if I would love it, but I would understand it, I guess.
Yeah, I'm looking at his numbers this season, and they're very similar to what they were the year before. So that would be 10 points, about 4 rebounds, 1.5 assists, and just under 2 stocks per game, with less than a turnover, 1.3 turnovers a night. So, I mean, like, that's solid production. It's just not, incredibly high level production. He's still young. There's still a lot of ceiling there, I would say, for him. I mean, he's a very good athlete. There's a good amount of potential. Like, I don't hate the gamble. I'm just not totally convinced that it's going to pay off. Do you know what I mean? Like, the idea of Patrick Williams on this roster is pretty great. The idea of Patrick Williams is a great fit next to Asar Thompson. But is the reality of Patrick Williams going to be a great fit next to Asar Thompson, right? Like, I don't know. It's a little bit more of a gamble. I'll give you the last word on Pat Will here before we move on.
Yeah, the only other thing I have is, like, it also, we don't really know what the Bulls plan is with him. Like, maybe you throw a $25 million a year offer sheet at him and they're like, okay, like thanks for taking this off my back, or maybe they are prepared to give him that sort of deal. You don't really know, which makes another risk element of it. I'm not in love with it, but I guess I'd understand again.
All right, so continuing the focus on the offseason, at John Pete Schwartz on Twitter is asking about the Bobby Marks offseason preview video for the Detroit Pistons. He says, I'm curious about your takes on the Bobby Marks Pistons offseason preview video. So, one, did you watch the video? I guess that's important for answering this question. But two, you know, what were your takeaways and just your general thoughts on Bobby Marks's analysis?
I did, yeah. The main points that stuck out to me, which I mean, it was very real. I think John in his comments said that it was very sobering. Bobby Marks just mentioned, now that you're making a change in your front office, this thing can take a while. Like, maybe their ideal person comes in and says, I can do this, or I think I can do this, but I'm going to need some time, like 3 years. And Wes, you mentioned it earlier, like, there's not much time for excuses anymore, but that person just might need time to, I don't think they'll necessarily need to strip everything down to the studs, but the state of where this team is, you don't really have much draft capital like some of the other teams in your situation do. It's just the reality of it. Another big point that Bobby Marks made was, how are we going to use this cap space this year? I think this is a thing that we've been talking about. Are you going to use it to sign some veterans to come in and help right away, like the Houston approach? Or are you going to kick the can down the road like we did last season, which I don't think we're really in much of a position to do that. He also talked about the free agent class, like, not being super great. Like, we have all this cap space, but what are you going to do? Overpay some guys? And there's probably not a ton of guys who are really hyped to come here in the first place. Whoever the leader is of this new front office needs to come up with a reason that they should come to Detroit, which is unknown or not really there right now. And then the last thing was Cade's extension. What are you going to do? So, I mean, the biggest point to me was really just the reality that there's still some time here, which is tough after these past few seasons. But right now, depending on who this hire is, what their idea is, and if you are bringing in a new GM and a new head coach, and however much you're turning over the roster, it's going to take some time, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, I had two thoughts on the time thing that you mentioned. I mean, one, it's very linked to the strategy that they take with their cap space, right? If you are in a situation where the new head man in charge thinks that this thing can turn around fairly quickly, or needs to turn around fairly quickly, then that's absolutely going to change what you do with that cap space. I mean, Bobby Marks mentioned maybe the Pistons take on Ben Simmons's contract to get in some draft assets or something along those lines, which really isn't a great path forward if you're going to try and accelerate out of the bottom here. And all of that discussion of time frame is very much, in my opinion, constrained by Cade Cunningham. He is your best player. He's the only sure thing on your roster outside of Simone Fontecchio, who is a restricted free agent at this point. So if you're going to turn around and build things, build the whole roster out around Cade Cunningham, you don't necessarily have 4 years before he may want out. You know, I think we've talked about this a little bit previously, but the moment he signs that extension, you've probably got 2 seasons after the extension kicks in. So practically 3 years, which was kind of on the bottom end of what the video was talking about, where you could still be normal bad. You wouldn't want to be as bad as they are right now, but, you know, closer to upper 20s, low 30s of win totals, right? And there are still paths up from there. The issue kind of comes in with doing something like that Ben Simmons trade, where you just take on Ben Simmons to get draft capital. That's not going to help you win games at all at this point. So, like, that's almost punting it too far down the line, in my opinion, anyway. I thought it was a really interesting video. Obviously, Bobby Marks is an expert, former GM. It was pretty cool to hear his take on all the assets that the Pistons have. You know, when he was bringing up the contract negotiations for Cade Cunningham, thinking about doing it maybe in the vein of Darius Garland, I thought that was a pretty good call out. Did you?
Yeah, and he also brought up like LaMelo Ball at that one too. I think, yeah, it was really interesting. I guess my thought, similar to you, is if, and normal bad is a really funny statement, by the way. I was like laughing in my head when you said that. Normal bad would be great right now. But if Cade signs the extension, like, realistically, how quickly do you think he could ask out if things are still bad?
I trade deadline the first year that it's in. So okay. He'd have next season is going to be the final year of his rookie contract. The first year that contract actually takes place, if they're still on pace to set franchise records, I could absolutely see a trade demand. I mean, he's in a really weird spot. It's tough to look back at former number one overall picks who have been reasonably good and close to the expectations that were set for them, which he has, especially this past season. But to find those guys that weren't built around immediately in the NBA, I mean, you could probably even expand that to top three picks as well, right? Like when Charlotte got LaMelo Ball, they kind of changed their trajectory. When, you know, obviously Luka Doncic, right? The Mavericks immediately changed their trajectory. Guys that find that immediate statistical success and start to validate their draft position usually get kind of featured as a centerpiece. And when you look at this roster, it's really difficult to make the argument that Cade Cunningham has. So in that way, I do think it's a little unique of a situation where there already might be some tension today, right now, where if it, you know, snowballs and they're still historically bad in a couple of seasons, then, you know, maybe this is uh-oh category. I did wonder after watching that video, if the new person comes in and thinks that, man, this roster's in such bad shape and this is going to be another 4 or 5 seasons before we're, you know, competing for mid-tier playoff seeds. If there's any inkling that Cade might not be on board for that long of a re-up, do you look at trading him? I mean, I feel awful saying that. I love Cade Cunningham. I don't want him to go anywhere. He's the only good thing they've got. But, like, if that's the situation, should they?
I don't know. I was sort of wondering that, too. Like, I've just been operating under the assumption that this mass extension is going to happen and, like, kind of be the one sure thing of this offseason. But another thing Bobby Marks said is, do you wait on the extension? Wait another season. Wait until everything else that shakes out, shakes out. And if that is the case, like if this extension isn't signed, I think that's, I don't want to say really telling because I'm still operating under assumptions, but I think it's more leads me to believe that people aren't on the same page and like Cade isn't totally on board, which I mean, I don't blame him. Like it, he had his first, one of them was injured, but his first few seasons he's barely won anything and he's looked great. So it's, I don't know. I feel like you have to commit to him long-term, but I understand, like it's a debate if you think there's no saving this thing and you might just want to like, I don't even want to say like think about trading him now because I don't think it's going to happen, but it's interesting nevertheless.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do not want that at all. And to harken back to something we were talking about earlier, I mean, I think that legitimately the only path to a pretty massive win total jump next season is to just kind of wipe the slate clean and build everything specifically tailored to Cade Cunningham's success. I don't know how, you know, fantastic long-term that would be. I don't love Cade as a heliocentric type guy, but Cade is a heliocentric type guy. I'm pretty confident with good pieces around could get you pretty far, at least in the regular season, and you know, far being play-in, which is really far from where they're at. So we're running low a little bit on time. Let's try and jump through some of these more quickly. Let's get this one. This was an interesting one. This is from Inoffensive Username in the DBB comment section. It says, just convince me that Jalen Duren isn't just Andre Drummond all over again.
Oh, man. I don't know if I can, but Andre Drummond, year two stats, 13.5 points per game, 13.2 rebounds per game, 1.6 blocks per game, and 1.2 steals. Jalen Duren, 13.8 points per game, 11.6 rebounds per game, 0.8 blocks per game, and 0.5 steals per game. I think like it's an interesting comparison because we know, we've talked about it at length. We don't have to harp on it any longer. Yes, Jalen Duren is a great rebounder. He has a lot of work to do as a rim protector and a defender overall. Same could have been said for Andre Drummond. He was obviously a better rim protector where at that point in their careers. And also like Andre didn't have a guy like Cade alongside him, which I think unlocks a lot of what Duren is doing, or at least like makes him, or not to pick on Jalen Duren, but playing with Cade makes any big man in that spot look better. So we are seeing a lot of parallels. Jalen Duren is obviously a much better free throw shooter than Andre Drummond ever was. But yeah, it kind of, you kind of can't help but draw comparisons to what they were, especially with like the things that we've been discussing on improvements that we'd like to see from Duren.
All right, here's my pitch, Blake. I think Jalen Duren is more skilled than Andre Drummond was. Jalen Duren can handle the ball better than Andre Drummond could. Jalen Duren is a better passer than Andre Drummond was at this point in their career. And all of this extra skill and footwork and craft on offense comes at the expense of the defense and a little bit of the rebounding. Andre Drummond was a better rebounder at this point. And so, yeah, I mean, Andre Drummond was at 2.8 stocks per game. Jalen Duren this season, 1.3. Not good for a center. So while Duren is much more skilled, and I would definitely put that qualifier, much more skilled, can get his own offense. Andre Drummond was a fairly significant better defender, even though he wasn't an incredible defender at the time. Let's stick on that front court discussion, though. This is from Team Raf. says, many are struggling to see the fit of Alex Saar and Jalen Duren in the front court. I would be one of them, for the record. But same. He wants to know what they would think, or what we would think, about Alex Saar and Isaiah Stewart in the front court.
Ooh, this is tough because I feel like the question here is, I guess, insinuating that Saar and Stewart would start alongside each other. My ideal situation would be, and Wes, I'm going to assume it might be yours too, is that Isaiah Stewart would be your backup five off the bench in this scenario. The thing is, like, Saar, he looks super skilled. He has work to do with his jump shot. He's shown flashes, like, it should come along, and that's why he is considered like the top prospect on a lot of people's boards this year. But I think right out of the gate, like, you shouldn't start them alongside each other. There's even a debate with Asar Thompson there, but especially if you're looping in Saar, Stewart, and Thompson on the floor at the same time. So, I mean, Saar and Duren are both centers. Like, there's no way around it. If you bring Saar in, you have to have the conversation on what you're doing with Jalen Duren. But I think Stu gives you a bit more flexibility to move him to the bench. If you are going to still start him, figure out what you're going to do with an Asar Thompson, for example. But the ideal fit to me is like Stu being the backup five, which I think we've wanted for a while.
I will say that I think in short bursts, Saar and Stewart would work together well on the court. That's not something that, like you said, that's not something you'd want starting. That's not even something you'd really want to get significant minutes of. But if your 2 5 men are Saar and Stewart, just in order to get both of them enough minutes a night, there's going to be some overlap. I think in that situation, I would prefer Isaiah Stewart to be playing the four. I know Saar's skilled. I don't really trust the handle yet. I do. Bryce always brings up that he's a little more Evan Mobley, and I agree. More Evan Mobley, less Chet Holmgren. So he's not going to be doing as much on his own. Still going to be very dependent on his guards, but he's going to be a very good defender right out of the gates, and maybe he can shoot it just enough to be a floor spacer. That's a five. That's very much a five to me. So I think for, you know, a few minutes a night, you could get away with that. It could be even something that you look into starting situationally if you're playing a team like Milwaukee, for example, so that you could stick one of those two on Giannis and the other on Brooke Lopez, potentially with the Philadelphia 76ers as well. That could be a decent matchup to kind of take Saar off of Joel Embiid, where I think he would get a little physically dominated. I mean, if your 3-man front court rotation is Saar, Asar, and Stu, I think it makes a lot of sense, and it would fit really well. Anything else to add quickly before we jump onto another one?
No, you bring up matchup specific. I was going to say like Cleveland too, especially if you need a little more size or just more like defensive heavy lineup. So yeah, I like that.
All right, let's jump to this one from Buzzard Beater. Wants to know what it might take to add Brandon Ingram from the New Orleans Pelicans in a trade. I would assume it'd be a lot. What do you got?
Man, so yeah, he is essentially now on an expiring. He makes $36 million next season, and then he's a free agent. So yeah, it's an interesting one because what do the Pelicans do? Like, can they, like, what direction are they heading? It might not take as much as you think, or it might take a heck of a lot more than you think. I think if you're going to bring in Brandon Ingram, you probably need to give up at least like one of Ivy or Duren, potentially both. I know they might even be more inclined towards Duren because I think Valanciunas is a free agent. So if they like him, and then I don't know if we need to attach draft assets like far down the road and We have the cap space to take it on. So it makes sense. I think it's just this one's really dependent on what the Pelicans do. It doesn't look like they're going to make a playoff run by any means. So they're in a situation where they have decisions to make this offseason too. And Ingram might be the guy that they're more willing to part with, definitely than Zion, but maybe they're interested in or prioritizing like CJ McCollum or paying some of their younger guys. So I don't know. I have a wide range on this one. Where are you at?
I think the challenging thing is just the lack of players that the Pistons have on the roster going into next season. So like on the books right now, Isaiah Stewart, Cade Cunningham, Asar Thompson, Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren, Quentin Grimes, Troy Brown, and Marcus Sasser. That's it. So if you're making a trade where you're giving up something, right, where you're going to, it's not just a straight salary dump, because in the offseason, they could just straight eat salary. Like you could pretty much send a second round pick to New Orleans if they just completely wanted to dump Brandon Ingram. You could do that. New Orleans wouldn't do that. You need to give them mm-hmm. something for it. So, you know, of Isaiah Stewart, Asar Thompson, Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren, Quentin Grimes, Troy Brown, and Marcus Sasser, you know, what pairing can you really put together that would really entice them to give you Brandon Ingram, who is an all-star and a very good player, though he does have some injury concerns. And I think you mentioned he's near the end of his deal. It just kind of makes it tough, especially if you're not all that willing to part with, you know, your Jaden Ivey or your Jalen Duren or even your Asar Thompson. I could imagine Quentin Grimes having some value, but he was hurt most of last season. It's probably a little deflated, at least a little bit. Marcus Sasser, I mean, former first round pick. So maybe there's something there that other teams are intrigued with and would value highly. I guess I could see guaranteeing Troy Brown's contract if someone just really wants to cut cap. But, you know, again, if they just want a salary dump, then the Pistons can facilitate that anyway without really sending anything out. So I just think they're in a difficult spot. And a lot of these trade discussions are going to rely on how attached the new president of basketball operations is to all young players not named Cade Cunningham and what that person's evaluation is of those guys. So, I mean, to answer the question directly, what would it take to add Brandon Ingram? Probably at a minimum, Jaden Ivey and a future pick. I would imagine it's probably more. It might be both Ivy and Duren or Ivy and Asar, plus that future pick. It would probably be a lot. I mean, Brandon Ingram's a very, very good player, all-star in the Western Conference. Like, yes, he gets hurt, but you'd take Brandon Ingram right now. He's a very good scorer, fits really well. Let's do one, maybe two more, depending on how quickly we go through this one. Could or should the Pistons aggressively pursue D'Angelo Russell in free agency? This is from @BasePistons on Twitter. What do you think? D'Lo as a fit for Detroit?
I mean, I think he'd fit fine. Like, we've seen what he's done in LA with like LeBron as the primary ball handler, and he's had a great season shooting. I just don't know if and this is going back to what Bobby Marks talked about, like, don't know if he's at a point in his career where he'd want to come to Detroit. Maybe he's trying to make his money and we make an aggressively overpriced offer. That's the only way I see it. I don't know if we should do something like that. It might be one of the only options to get a player like that.
Defensively, he's bad, right? He's not a very good defender at all. But if you want to start him next to Cade Cunningham and just go all offense, like, I get it. The guy can score. He's a very good shooter. And he's, like you said, he's already shown that he can play off ball quite a bit. He has done it a lot this season. He's also a good pick and roll ball handler, good catch and shoot guy, as we mentioned, and is, you know, very, very skilled. He's also not all that old at this point. I'm going to look it up really quickly. This is bad podcasting, but I want to get his age. D'Angelo Russell is only 28 years old, so he's still got a couple years before he hits 30. Like, I'm not saying there's more ceiling there, but you're not exactly anticipating a precipitous drop-off of his play, right? So, I mean, yeah, as far as quick fixes go, I don't love it, but he can score, he can shoot. Offensively isn't a bad fit, though he is a little bit of a wild card in that way. I don't love it. I would get it if they wanted to go for it. But like you said, could you even convince him to show up? Last one. If the Warriors make Andrew Wiggins available and also obviously kind of give the Pistons a thing or two to get off that contract, would you make an offer and what would it be? This is from JMac 760 in the DBB comments, and we will probably end on this one.
Yeah, so Wiggins has like a much more long-term deal. He's making 26 next year, 28 the year after. And then the real kicker is he has a $30 million player option in 2026, 2027. So this is like a totally the Warriors want to get off his contract move to me. Like, I don't feel like you should give up much of anything to take on that contract. Maybe the Pistons are willing to do it because there's not really anyone in the free agent market that's enticing them or that they're able to bring in on deals that are comfortable for both parties. But I don't know. To me, this one looks like a total just, hey, X team, like, we'll give you X for taking on this contract. I know Andrew Wiggins is still an okay player, had a rough year, but based on where the Warriors are, like, I don't see them having much leverage to bring back anything of significance in an Andrew Wiggins deal. Am I off on that?
No, I don't think so. I do think it would be a salary dump for the Warriors, and YouTube user brings it up. Like, I do already think that Wiggins is available, right? I mean, it's not like it's a secret at this point. He had a really rough year. He's getting paid a lot of money. I don't think he's as bad as he was this season. I think there's still a pretty effective wing in there. He is still a good athlete. He's a better shooter than he showed this past season. So in terms of like fit with Detroit, he'd fit in pretty well. He's a good defender too, right? So, you know, him and Ausar Thompson, not a bad 1-2 punch there out on the wings at the forward positions. You know, it's going to be more than a second round pick. I think at this point, I could imagine there are a few teams that would want Andrew Wiggins, or at least would want to take the chance, have the cap space and not all that much to lose, very similar to the Detroit Pistons. So, you know, maybe it's like Marcus Sasser in a second round pick, and then you get Andrew Wiggins back and bank on him kind of rekindling some of the magic he had a couple of seasons ago in San Francisco. I mean, I wouldn't hate it if it's that low. Right. I wouldn't hate that at all. He does fit well.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about the cap going up too, but it's just like, if he is what he is this year, like $30 million in 2-3 years from now, is like, yikes. Are you willing to take that risk?
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Let's just give the shout out here because Piston legend Blake Griffin retired this week. And Shag's just in the DBB comments, you know, he wants to ask, like, was that 2018-2019 season the highlight of the past 15 or 16 years of Pistons basketball? I mean, it's up there. Blake was incredible. Shout out to Blake Griffin on an incredible career.
Yeah, probably. I think the only other thing that sticks out to me as like a highlight in the past 15 to 16 years is when the Pistons won the lottery, the Cade Cunningham year, and I'm talking about in that moment because we know the state of the team right now, but what Blake did was incredible. Wes, we talked about this off air a few times, talking about like crazy performances we've seen in person. I was at that game where he dropped the 50 points against Philly, and I think you mentioned you saw Anthony Davis do it at the Palace, right? when he was on the Pelicans. Yeah, it's
got the Palace record for most points scored in the building when he was with the Pelicans. Checked by Tobias Harris, who is a free agent target, apparently, or could be. So, you know, it's all full circle here on the pin down.
It really is. But no, what Blake did and how he, like, willed that team to the playoffs when his leg was pretty much taped together. He had, like, the mattress on his leg, like people like to say, is crazy. He put in, I mean, he gave the team a lot, really all he had. So shout out to him. I hope he enjoys his retirement.
I think you're just biased because you and him have the same first name. Like, I think you just like the idea of referring to someone, you know, lifting the Pistons onto their shoulders and saying, yeah, Blake did that. That's what I think. Because I feel like you're overlooking that 44-win season where Reggie Jackson and Andre Drummond were just incredible in the pick and roll, and they then got swept by the Cavs. But that was a fun year. I mean, you had the Blazers fourth quarter comeback. That was insane. You had the KCP breakaway dunk on LeBron James in the playoffs, like, and the Palace was pumping. Like, that was a good year. That's a highlight. I don't know if that's like top of the top, but those are probably the only three highlights that I can think of out of the past 15 years.
Yeah.
So credit to Blake for putting one together.
Yeah. Hey, you're right. He made it really fun to be a Blake in the Metro Detroit area when he was around. So shout out to him for that. But I mean, what a career. Like the way he, I guess, retooled his game when he didn't have the, I mean, he was always athletic, but he didn't have like the, I guess, just like athletic power that he once did because of where his health was, is insane. So yeah, very happy for him. Great career, legend. I hope he gets into the Hall of Fame one day. He should, but I feel like that's a debate.
I feel like he should as well, but guys, we're gonna wrap it up. To everyone that tuned in live, thank you so much. We appreciate you, everyone that submitted the questions as well. Thank you. We appreciate y'all. This is very much a fan-driven show. So all these questions, all the participation we get, we love it. We appreciate it all. Blake, thanks as always. Great show. Why don't you close us out?
Yeah, thank you, everyone. And be sure to like and subscribe to the Detroit Bad Boys YouTube, whether you're listening to us on whatever podcast platform. Really helps us push things along, so we truly appreciate it. And special thanks to Sean Corp, our managing editor over at Detroit Bad Boys, for supporting the show. And shout out to you guys again for all the great questions and talking points. We'll catch you next week, whether on your commute or live with us here on YouTube. We can't wait to talk Detroit basketball with you all.